I was actually expecting a much smaller roundtable discussion, but this is many tables now today. And so I'll try and have it as interactive as possible. So I'll talk for a little bit, but please feel free to stop me at any time. So it's great to be here, and it's great to be a Berkman Fellow this year. I really plan to use the Berkman Center as a platform to study, research, and promote open science. Today I'll talk about open science, and I'll talk also about an initiative that I'm part of. It's a startup, it's very young, and it's called Authoria, or Authoria, it depends on where you put the accent. It's an online collaborative platform to write academic papers. So we're trying to reinvent the way we write academic papers for scholars and for scientists in general. Just a couple of disclaimers before I start. I'm not an expert of open science, so you'll find that my talk is a little rough around the edges. This is the first time I talk about open science, and I have an open access expert in the room. So I'll try my best, and please stop me at any time, and we can somehow have a proper discussion. You know, so let's just pretend that we're in a much smaller room. Also, my interest and my passion for open science is very practical. I don't know too much about the theoretical or ethical, moral, philosophical foundation for why open science is the right way. But I've been in science for the past 15 years now, working in the hard sciences and information science to support the hard sciences. And I think that opening up scientific sources, scientific content, sharing data, sharing tools, sharing ideas is the only way to practically make science better, to foster collaboration, to foster exchange of ideas, and to advance science more in general. So normally I like to start all my talks talking for a couple of minutes about myself and where I'm coming from. I wasn't going to do it today because it doesn't really make much sense because I'll talk about a new topic, but instead I decided to do it anyways. So you'll get a very small, just a few minutes introduction to see where I'm coming from, and you'll see that it probably makes sense if I show you a little bit about what I've done in the past, and then you'll get an idea of like what where I'm going in the future and why I'm trying to do this and why I'm working with open science. So I have a I'm trained in astrophysics, and then I did a master's in computer science, and I've been working then for a few years. I worked in research in academic institutions, the University of Bologna, and then at CERN in Geneva. I worked at the intersection between computer science and astronomy. So I was doing astronomical visualization, for example. I then worked at CERN, and I started working with with libraries for the first time. I was working in close collaboration with the CERN library and promoting open access among particle physicists. And I was also developing tools to actually make open access a reality. I then got my PhD at UCLA in information science. And for the past couple of years, I've been a postdoc at the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard. And they like to call me the in-house information scientist within the astronomy department. So that's where I am right now. If you look at my teaching record, it's a little more diverse. And it shows that I've been sort of I've had an identity crisis, academic identity crisis, because I don't know really where to go. Most of the classes I've been teaching are either in social science, social studies of science and technology. That's what I was teaching at UCLA. Thank you. Then I started teaching another class called Art, Science, and Technology, which was very cool. Here at Harvard, I've mostly been teaching data visualization, which is not even my my field of expertise, but somehow I've worked, I've done some visualization work, so I ended up doing teaching those classes. So now I'm going to just introduce you very quickly a couple of projects that I work on or that I worked on that somehow show that I've been close to science for these past few years. This is my dissertation work, which is on scientific collaboration networks. So I was at UCLA, and I was studying a research center, which was distributed, very large, very interdisciplinary. I looked at the scientific collaboration within the center, and I analyzed three different traces: how scientists were writing papers with one another, that's the scholar network. I was looking at how scientists were communicating with one another using a mailing list, and how scientists were in touch with one another, so how they actually knew each other in real life, so their acquaintanceship network. So you can see that already I've been interested in the study of science for a few years. That was my PhD work. More recently, this is a paper that will appear in PLOS ONE in the next month or so. I looked at how new ways to measure sciences. So in particular, new ways to compare scientists across time and discipline and try to remove the bias of the H-index, the bias that happens when you try and compare two different scientists across time and across different disciplines. Another thing I'm working on right now, and I'm very passionate about this, I'm running an all-sky survey using the astrophysics data system, the ADS, as our source of data. The ADS is the largest repository in astronomy. That's if there's any astronomer in the room, that's what every single astronomer uses, and that's what that's the place to go to find literature, to find papers, to find new stuff. And we're extracting all the images from this amazing corpus of literature that we have, all the images from the papers, and we're plotting them in the sky. So we're doing some astrometric calibration. It's like almost face recognition, but for stars instead of faces. So we're putting the images back in the sky and creating an historical layer of the sky so that you can see what parts of the sky have been studied over time. There's also some more lightweight projects that I worked on, and it's still projects that have to deal with data. So I'm going to even give you a one-minute introduction to some of these projects. I worked with the music data a few years ago, so I analyzed the online and offline listening behavior of a famous American band, the Grateful Dead. I also looked at political data, blogosphere data. This study is actually very close to some of the topics that you deal with here at the Berkman. So I analyzed how the mobilization and activity on a blog, on a political blog, ended up being an actual offline protest in the streets of Italy a few years ago. I also work a lot with Twitter data, and I analyzed mashed up Twitter content, which was mostly text, with images from Flickr, and created a multimodal installation, a platform that mashes up Twitter data with images, related images from Flickr. And then this is the most fun project that I've probably done in the past few years because it involves red balloons. I analyzed the a text of emails sent to the future, and I tried to make an installation outside of UCLA that involves balloons where different shades of red represent different mood states. So the reason I showed you all of this is to show you that every single time that I have a project going on, even if it involves just red balloons in actual physical space, I always associate a paper. So every single time I showed you a project, there's always a paper associated with that. So why am I doing that? Why am I writing papers for every single project that I have? Well, the idea is that I'm a scholar and I'm interested in building my own academic resume. And like many other scholars, I try and publish and write a paper for whatever little project I have. And until a few years ago, I was actually very interested in writing papers. I thought that it was a lot of fun to write papers. But things have changed in the past couple of years, I said, I think. And the reason for that is that I still think that there's a lot of fun. Doing research for me is a lot of fun. And I also like writing very much. But the moment we have to package our research in a format to allow it to be disseminated, then two problems arise. First of all, we have to start dealing with tools and systems which are just not adequate for the kind of modern digital online research that we're doing. And the second thing is that we also have to deal with paper formats which are imposed by the journals that just belong to the past and ignore the fact that we're doing science online in a modern way, in a collaborative manner as well. So I think there's too much of a disconnect between how research gets done and how we get our hands dirty with data, we play and interact with data, and how then we package that all that research in the format of a paper. The moment our research gets into the paper, it dies. It stops being alive. That's my view. So think of an image, for example, a plot that you produce for a paper that you're writing. You might be spending months on that image, just refining it and making it better and better, trying different tools, different platforms. And then at the end, when you produce the final version of the image and you include it in a paper, what you put in the paper is pretty much just a photograph of the image, just an image rendering of the of that image. So it's the same thing as printing the image, taking a photograph, and that's what you're inputting into your paper. So all the work you put into that image, all the data, the iterations, the processes, the analysis, the workflows, even the hands of the people that touch that image, because it might be not just yourself. Science is a very collaborative endeavor. So all of that disappears from view when you publish a paper in a closed format, like PDF, for example. So we go from a very dynamic, collaborative, open environment, a digital environment of data manipulation and analysis, to a closed, static, dead environment. And if you think about it a little more, it's, you know, what we're doing is that as scientists and scholars, we're actually producing cutting-edge research, which totally belongs to the century. In fact, the research we produce is so great that, you know, it belongs to the next century. It's fast-forward-looking. But then the kind of tools, the systems that we're using to write up that research are totally 1980s. Microsoft Word or LaTeX, and I'm going to ask around what kind of tools you use in here, because I'm very curious. These tools totally belong to the past. They belong to the past century. They don't take into account of the nature of science, which is collaborative. They don't take, you know, they don't support large-scale collaboration. They don't produce dynamic web content, and they lock all the work you do into a PDF or any other closed format, I like to say in a coffin, because the moment it gets in there, you can't do anything with it. And what's even funnier, I think, is that we're formatting papers in a manner which was invented hundreds of years ago. It was totally appropriate in the time of Galileo, and it somehow reflects the culture and political structure of a late Renaissance Italy, but it's not appropriate for today. I don't want to criticize this too much, because some people are in love with the way papers look, but all I have to say is that it simply does not belong to the digital world. That format belongs to a printed world, and it's not appropriate for the digital online world. And in this context, I always like to refer to this quote by Clifford Lynch, who's a guru in the digital library community, and he says that the publishers are indeed doing print and digital publication, but print and digital are essentially the same. They're identical. So what you get online is an image rendering, a photograph of a physical page, a printed physical page, which is complete with a lot of artifacts that we don't need, such as the multiple columns. If anyone in the room is familiar with the computer science community, they still publish, I would say, 90% of their papers in a multiple column, double column format, which is totally pointless in a digital online world. So I think we need a new way to write, to disseminate, and to read science. And I think we need to start from writing. The only way to truly take advantage of the online digital medium is to start from writing and reinvent the way that we're writing papers. I would like to begin by outlining some of the problems with the way that we write papers today. And then I'll talk about some possible solutions, and I will show you a little demo of my new little system that hopefully will solve some of these problems that we're moving in that direction. So first of all, first problem is that, as I mentioned already, most software tools, if not all software tools, that scientists and scholars use today to write articles are simply not intended for a collaboration. And this is a fact. I'm referring mostly to two tools here, Microsoft Word and LaTeX, because they are by far the most used tools in the hard sciences, and I think even social sciences and in the humanities. For people in the physical sciences, physics and astronomy, LaTeX is by far the most used system to typeset articles. But if you look just beyond the physical sciences, I think that Microsoft Word accounts for, I read a paper where they had a survey and accounts for like 85% of papers are still written in Microsoft Word, which is pretty crazy. Can I just ask around if there's, how many of you use Microsoft Word to write papers or? So I would say the vast majority. LaTeX, anyone? Okay, so it's a large, I would say one third. Any other format that you'd like to share? Yes?
I started using things like Google Docs. Mm-hmm. That's still Microsoft Word, but it's a little bit.
It's, yeah. And?
It's a little bit, it's weird to hear. Because I use the fact that I often write in different editors based on the number of right? So
and then,
some
yeah.
Some of the interface is a lot more like Word and sometimes on the computer. And sometimes it's something that you could add or.
Okay.
So it seems like, if I'm really collaborative, it seems like it's a weird...
Okay. No, but that's wonderful. I mean, I'll talk about it like in just 5 minutes. I'll get to your point. How we're trying to adapt existing tools, and then eventually we have to like use these tools because they're the tools imposed by journals. Yeah. Any...
You can talk.
To write
that. The idea being that I'm going to output a Word document, right? I've done that many times.
Yeah.
Is that I'm using Microsoft Word? I mean, in your model, is that...
You're using tech for me, but you're using Word as the platform which you're writing tech. But you're essentially, you know, if you're doing that, you're using both of them, which, again, they're not intended for collaboration. But you might be using an online Google Doc system and write tech within the Google Doc, and then you're somehow doing a better job in a way, right? It's a little more efficient. And I have two more. Yeah.
I think you're combining several orthogonal issues.
Uh-huh.
We have certain editors that are WYSIWYG, like you see as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Others that provide some special capability for rendering
mm-hmm.
or formatting. For example, LaTeX, basically, the usual use of it is to render it into the format that's required for submission into some paper. But there's also the issue of rendering to different screen formats. And even with computer integration, then you get the issue of what platform you're displaying it on. As just one example, iBooks will run on an iPad, but if
mm-hmm.
I want to blow it up to show it on my computer screen, I can't run it on my MacBook Pro. So there are a lot of rendering and compatibility issues there, even with electronic media.
And that's the problem. So what I'm trying to say is that that's a problem. I understand that I'm mixing some of these things because some people use very different tools.
And orthogonal to all that is the collaboration issue.
Yes. Yeah. So all I have to say is I understand what you're saying, and I'm pretty familiar with these tools, and I totally understand what you're saying. But I think that that's exactly the problem. We have to come up with a system that is a little more straightforward, and it sort of does all those tasks that you're talking about at the same time, and it's collaborative at the same time because we have to bring everything to the web. So like our that should be the standard. And I'll talk about it like more, but thank you. And do you want to mention what you use? Or
yes.
Yeah.
Two, mostly from the creative area and also from the area of ADD. One's mind mapping, because you see the whole system and how the components relate to each other, and you can even see the flows. And the other is a lot of stuff that Edward Tufte does.
Uh-huh.
A lot of his work, the spark lines and other things, are very simple, but they keep the narrative, they keep the data dynamic,
mm-hmm.
even though it's on a flat
mm-hmm.
piece of paper and it's not moving.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your contributions here. So if you're familiar with Word, you know that there's been some movement in the direction of like making it a little more collaborative, or at least more aware of version control. So they introduced the track changes feature a few years ago, and it's a bit of a nightmare, but at least it's there, and some people use it, and it somehow gives you an idea of what's been done on a paper by whom. It doesn't work cross-platform, and it doesn't work very well, but it is there, so it's a move in the right direction. But I think that the biggest drawbacks for all these tools, for some other tools that other people mentioned as well, is that these tools work offline. And because they work offline, they fail to take advantage of the native collaborative nature of the web. So the next problem that I find is that most software tools, if not all software tools that we mentioned so far, simply do not take into account for the digital and dynamic nature of scientific research materials. In other words, they're not written specifically for science, even though LaTeX is. It does many things in a way that is 1980s or 1990s. I'm sorry to say that, but that's That's a fact. And I hate working with LaTeX because it breaks all the time and I can never find where it's breaking and what's happening. So I don't have to tell this community that the web has become the de facto, the official medium of knowledge production and exchange in scholarly circles and in science. You know this better than me. The Berkman Center is a center of excellence for the study of the web. The web, we know it, is used in science and in scholarship as a means of communication. We're exchanging ideas and papers, topics via email or using social media and social networking sites. And I think we can even think of the web as a distributed cognitive platform for doing research. And when I say this, I'm reminded of a lot of great projects, such as the Polymath project, which is a large-scale collaborative initiative in mathematics, where many mathematicians all over the world are using a blogging platform to actually come up with ideas and write papers online together. It's like hundreds of researchers doing that. And it's something that's beyond a paper if you think about it, because it's really existing on a blogging platform. But despite initiatives like this, like the Polymath project, by and large, a lot of online scientific communication takes place via the exchange of articles in PDF. That's what we still do. So we may be using very fancy repositories, very nice social media platforms, or whatever. But at the end of the day, what we're doing, we're still reading and exchanging PDF files. And why are we doing this? Because we're using Microsoft Word or LaTeX or similar tools that at the end of the day output PDF files. And PDF files are, unfortunately, ignore the born digital nature of some research objects, as I was saying before. An image, for example, you might be spending a lot of time on it, but eventually it becomes just a photograph into a PDF file. And a PDF, as I was saying, is just an image rendering of a physical paper, because it retains the purpose and the format of the physical paper, and it does not expose the living, dynamic nature of research, all the stuff that you find in the data, the tables, images, software code, and so on. There's also something else, that science is becoming more and more collaborative. Again, this is one thing that I don't have to mention to this community because you're very familiar with this, but just to show you one graph that comes from my field of astronomy. That's a graph showing how the fraction of papers and the number of authors in the 1960s and then every 10 years up to just a couple of years ago. So in the 1960s, which is the empty little point at the top, it's that line over there, there were about 62% of all papers in astronomy were written just by one person, one author. If you look at the same in 2009, so 3 years ago, that percentage is just below 5%. So two in three papers in 1960 in astronomy were written by only one person, and now that percentage has gone down by a lot. So if you look at what's happening today, is that most papers in astronomy are written by two, three, four, five, and even more authors. Papers that are written by just one person are very rare. And is this... Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So what happens is that as we get into more into this collaborative environment, as more and more authors become involved in the writing of papers, then two problems arise. And the first one is that it becomes more and more difficult to keep track and possibly reproduce as well the exact steps that were taken to make a data table, an image, an equation, or even to write a paragraph in an article. So I do know it's true that scholars are increasingly sharing and publishing the sources of their research on the web. So I work with libraries, so I know that there's a lot of data, digital libraries, repositories for analytical tools and for the code that you use to analyze your data. Source code, of course, there's a lot of data repositories for software, images, Figshare, for example, and so on. So there are amazing repositories out there. But I think that this is not enough to really guarantee long-term preservation of research products, because we need more information, not just the data, in order to fully reconstruct the detailed workflow of science, what actually happened to what happened to produce a given image or a data table, and so on. So to make science a little more intelligible, we need not only the research materials, but also the relationships that exist between these materials. And this problem of the research transparency and the reproducibility of research results being at stake is not only a problem for extremely large collaborations with hundreds of authors and so on. It happens to me as well. I have papers written with two or three other people, and sometimes I really don't know what's going on. I have to get in touch with my co-authors and say, how do you produce that image? Like, that looks different from what we had a week ago and what I produced a week ago. And I have to, like, keep emailing back and forth simply because all the processes, all the analysis that they did on their machines is not available to me. And sometimes it even happens to myself. I was looking back at some dissertation data, so it's my work only, and I couldn't even figure out what I did myself. That's a problem, and we need to find a way to actually be able to look back at the data and actually make research reproducible and transparent so that anyone can see how an image was produced. The second problem with growing collaboration is that it becomes really hard to figure out and to discern individual contributions to a given paper or a project. What you find, what I put here on the right is a recent paper in astronomy. It's got 700 authors, and that's the first page and a half of the paper. There's three pages of authors, and there's two additional pages of affiliation. So what does this all mean, right? I mean, it's in astronomy and in pretty much all different academic fields, we do need to write papers because that's how we determine the prestige and the career of scholars. If you publish a first author piece in a high-impact journal, you might get tenure or you might get the grant that you've been hoping to get, right? That's how it works. But today, with author lists that just go over, you know, tens or hundreds of authors, sometimes even thousands of authors, it's really impossible to determine the volume, the shape, and the quality of individual contributions to these joint efforts. Still, we need joint efforts, right? Because a lot of science happens, and we can produce amazing scientific results because we're collaborating at this, you know, in these large, huge collaborations. So, with all these problems in mind, we've been looking around and we've been trying to understand what scientists are doing to overcome some of these problems. And as I was saying before, we noticed that there's a lot of people, a lot of scientists, a lot of scholars that are moving to online solutions. So they're using, for example, Google Docs, sometimes even to author in collaboration a LaTeX document, and then they finally, when they're done editing collaboratively, they go back to a LaTeX compiler and then just compile the paper into a PDF. So Google Docs is an amazing tool, and it's, as someone said, it's an online version of Word. That's what it is. The problem is that it's not really built for scholarship. It's not built for science. So a lot of the things I talked about, you simply cannot you cannot develop them within a Google Doc environment. What I find fascinating is that many scientists are moving or are trying to understand how markup works. So they're able to use MediaWiki or other markup languages like Markdown, and they know how to do simple markup and to produce HTML documents, which is a great standard and one source of inspiration for what we're trying to do with Authoria. Two other sources of inspiration, things we've been looking at, is new programming languages such as Python, for example. A lot of scholars and scientists are using Python to do their pretty much their entire data analysis for their papers. And there are packages out there, such as Matplotlib, that these packages allow you to plot the results of your analysis. And what's nice here is that you're using one programming language, one environment, to actually do everything from your initial analysis, data crunching, even the data collection, up to the point of visualizing your data. So that entire process somehow can be moved online, and we can do something with it to make it a little more collaborative. And then the real hipsters in science use D3.js. I don't know if anyone is familiar with that. It's a pretty great tool. It's a plotting environment. It's all JavaScript. So you input your data, and all you have to do is write a JavaScript, and then you produce actually interactive plots, which have to exist on the web. Otherwise, they don't have sense to exist, pretty much. And that's fantastic, because we're working for my startup, for my initiative, we're working with web-based content. So something like a JavaScript-based tool to plot images, to plot data is fantastic, because it can be easily integrated within an authoring system that exists on the web. Another thing we've been noticing is that scientists are and scholars are, instead of exchanging and sending back and forth by email the latest version of the paper, they're just syncing all their folders using Dropbox. And that's a great thing, because, of course, you don't have to keep sending back and forth papers, and you can have a place where you share all your work, whether it's figures, images, data, software, and so on. And then I think that the biggest inspiration for what we're doing is open source collaborative platforms like GitHub, which is a social coding platform. And GitHub is somehow powered by a Git backend. Git is a versioning control system, which is mostly used for software, but you can essentially use it for anything. And that's what we're using in Authoria, to actually make sure that the version control and source control is taken care of. And it's also a social networking tool, because you get to know what developers next to you are working on. And it's also great, because whatever you do is somehow transparently appears on your homepage, so that a lot of developers these days, instead of having a LinkedIn account, they just have a GitHub account. And if employers just go have a look at their GitHub page, because the GitHub page shows everything that they worked on. So GitHub is becoming a great tool, not just to manage and expose the work you do in computer science, but also in a way it's incentivizing open source. And it's one of the true reasons why open source is working so well in computer science. So with all this tools in mind, we are building this thing that so far is called Authoria. And it's an online collaborative platform to write scientific papers. That's what it is. It's built in Ruby on Rails, and we're still, we're at the very early stages of development here. So what I'll show you today is not specifically the most beautiful and polished version of a tool, but in the spirit of open science, I'm going to show you whatever I have, and feel free to criticize and kill me with questions. Just before I do that, show you some faces. I'm the co-founder of this initiative, which is a spin-off of Harvard University and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And after today, I hope to make this an official Berkman initiative as well. My co-founder is Nathan Jenkins. He's a postdoc in physics at NYU and at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. So he's a physicist, a postdoc. Then we have a consultant, Matteo Cantiello. He's at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's also a postdoc in astrophysics. And my supervisor, Alyssa Goodman, who could not be here today, unfortunately. She's a professor here at Harvard, and she works at the Center for Astrophysics with me, and she's our scientific advisor, or I like to say our godmother for the project. So as you can tell, there's a lot of, we're skewed towards physics and astronomy here, but we develop, so, and I hope we develop okay, so that we're trying to develop something that is useful. But the reason we're skewed towards physics and astronomy is because we're building a tool that initially will be useful to physicists and astronomers. This is the community that we know best, and we're trying to build a tool that will be useful to our community. Hopefully, you will see that this tool can be easily adapted and it can be used by scholars in other disciplines, and with my connection to the Berkman, I hope that somehow this can somehow go into new disciplines as well outside of physics and astronomy. So, I'll just say a couple of points about Authoria, and then I'll try to show you a demo, and we can make it interactive so that you can ask me things while I'm doing that. So the main point, though, that I want to make is that Authoria is a website, It exists on the web, and it uses the web as its canvas. Authoria speaks the language of the web. So we're trying to develop a system that is entirely on the web, and every single document, every single paper you write on this platform is in HTML5. So you can edit papers online using any modern browser of your choice, and you can use any markup language you would like, MediaWiki, Markdown, or even LaTeX. You can import and you can write equations using MathML or LaTeX, but eventually everything renders back to HTML5. And then the other thing I'd like to mention, and then I'll move over there and I'll try to load up a demo, is that we're really thinking of an online system that takes care of versioning and source control. By versioning control, I mean that every document is a living web document. It can be continuously changed, amended, to reflect, I think, the spirit of science. And science and scholarship is subject to constant review and revision. So we're sort of playing with that idea in mind. We have a Git backend that provides the versioning control and the source control as well, which means that every single edit or any single change that is done to a paper is recorded and is logged so that you can backtrack your paper. It's like an infinite undo button so that you can take the paper back to its original version. And this allows us to really create scientific resumes, if you want. So just like the same thing that developers do on GitHub, we can do a similar thing on Authoria just by having a Git backend. So before just carrying on with all this, like, talk, I'll just show you what it looks like so far. So here's the warning. Is anyone familiar with Twitter Bootstrap here in the room or not? Okay, to a lot of people that are familiar with the CSS framework we're using, this will look annoyingly familiar because we're using to actually style the pages, we're using a CSS framework which is called Twitter Bootstrap. It comes from Twitter, and it looks like that. Which is fine, but we're still looking for designers, web designers, and we don't have much money, but if you know any who would like to work on a project, then send them my way. So I'm going to log in, and I'm logging as myself. And what you get when you log in, and hopefully it will work, yes, it's a list of articles that I'm working on. Can you all see? Is that fine? Yeah? So you see a list of articles. So this is a paper with a title, and I'm the owner because I created it, and it was created 7 days ago and updated about 20 hours ago. You can... The third one is a... Oh, yeah, I know. That's by my... by my co-founder. So you can create a new article and a new live article. And you can define whether you want to create it in, you want to write in Markdown, which is our markup language of choice, or you want to write in LaTeX, or if you just want to write it in whatever language you want. And then I'll show you how you can choose different languages while you go along. You can choose it to create from a template or not, and then you can make it public or you can make it private. And I'll talk a little more about the public-private thing in a second. And I have a couple more points to make towards the end. So I create a new live article right here. Well, let's just go to my safe article that I created 7 days ago. So this is what an article looks like, an online article. It has a title at the top, and it's got a list of collaborators here. In this case, it's all my my people that are working on. And this is a dynamic list of authors. So I can, for example, remove my advisor, Alyssa, from this paper, and in a second that she disappears from the list of authors. But just to be safe, let's add her back. Otherwise, she'll get mad at me. So now she's back on the author list. I'm an admin, and I can make other people admin as well. So I can go to my co-founder, and I can make it an admin, and then he's going to appear in blue as well. And if you're an admin, you have sort of special privileges, so you can do things like delete articles and things like that. So in a way, an admin is like a first author, something like that. And clearly, we don't want just one first author, but many first authors. So the article itself looks like a normal article in what you see on a PDF. So it's got things like boldface and, you know, italic quotes, mathematical notation, things like equations, LaTeX tables, figures, and then citations down here, and a list of references at the very end. Now, because I'm an actual collaborator on this article, I'm an admin, every time I hover on a paragraph, you can see that at the very bottom, you get some additional buttons that show up, such as insert. I can check out the item, I can delete it, or I can edit it. And so if I just click edit, what I get is that I can just online add some text here. And this is a LaTeX machine so that I can actually write something in italic. And that, you see, that's up here. It's just added something. I can also insert a new paragraph. And when I insert a paragraph, I can decide whether I want to make it LaTeX or Markdown. And you see there's many other options, including BibTeX, or I can write in MediaWiki, which is what you use to write in Wikipedia. So what I'm trying to say here is that if you have different collaborators on a paper that like to write in LaTeX and some other ones that like to write in Markdown, we have to allow to do so. So they write in whatever language they want, and eventually everything renders back to HTML5. That's the whole point, to use HTML5 as a standard for... so let's call this methods. And let's just say this is the method section. And it's LaTeX. So I can write mathematical notation here. So I can do things like that. And there it is. And I can add a little bit of a title if I wanted to. So subsection. So now we should have a new paragraph in here. So what I would like to show you, okay, is that, as I said, you can write mathematical notations, things like any LaTeX common works in here, and equations is the same thing. You see, this is a beautiful equation here. I can double click on it, and click on edit, and I can edit the equation over here. So I can add something here, plus t. And if I save and close, the equation is automatically updated. So everything that you do renders back into HTML5. That's the important part. Same thing with tables. This is a pretty bad table that it's not that great. And figures I will show you in a second. Before, I want to show you that whenever you're writing, you're editing a paragraph, you're essentially checking out the paragraph so that no one else can touch it. And this is, in a way, a nice feature compared to systems like Google Docs, where if everyone is working on the same paragraph at the same time, it gets a little messy sometimes. Instead, what we're trying to do, I think that the way scholars and scientists want to work is that if they're working on a paragraph or a section, just let them work on that section and no one else can touch it. So let's just say that I open a new browser window in Safari in a different thing. And here I'm logged in as you see, Nathan, my co-founder, whereas on Firefox I'm logged in as myself. So if I, let's just go back to this one and make it a little smaller. Hope you can see it. Yeah, it shows. So if I now start editing the abstract, and let's just go to the very beginning and say, I am editing this. Now I go to the browser window of my co-founder, Nathan. Let's just pretend to be him for a second. Go to the home page and go to the same article. What you'll see is that if I now hover on top of this paragraph over here, it says that it's checked out by me. So I cannot work on it. Of course, I can go and edit the method section because no one is touching it. So I can go here, and I'm editing this one. Well, there's a type in there. So I can save and close this. And then the moment I save and close on my initial window, the abstract, if I go back to Nathan's, it's already updated. So it's the system of checking in and checking out allows you to work on different parts of the paper, but at the same time, it's a very dynamic system because whatever I'm editing up here, so let's try again. One more time. The moment I press save and close, go back to Nathan's thing. Here it is. It's already updated. So many people in different locations can work on the same thing, but it's somehow safe because the check-in and check-out thing takes care of not allowing two people to edit the same thing at the same time. Everything is logged. So this is the article view that I'm showing you up here. But in fact, there's a backend, the folder view, that shows you what the article looks like on how it would look like on your machine if it was just a bunch of files. So every single paragraph, every single section, every single figure, the bibliography, everything is sitting in a folder view. So this is what your folder looks like. So if you go to the bibliography section, for example, you will see that there's a bibliography file that has all the different. It's a BibTeX for people that use LaTeX. They know what I'm talking about. It's also got a news feed, just similar to a news feed on Facebook, but in fact, it's a news feed for an article. So everything that I did to this article today, October 9th, is logged, and it tells me that, for example, I edited the abstract just a minute ago, and then yesterday Nathan did some work on it, and if you go back, you'll see that Alyssa and Matteo did some work on it too in the past few days, and so on. And you can revert back to these versions at any time. And not only that, you can also see exactly what was done to a given, what was deleted and added to a given paragraph or an image, everything. Everything is logged back, and you can revert to it. Now, I just want to show you a couple more things that you can do in the article view. I talked about equations. I talked about tables. Now, images. Or before images, let me just maybe mention the citations. So citations work in the same way that they work in LaTeX, if you want to use LaTeX. I'm not talking here about Markdown today. But the moment you add a citation, if it's in your bibliography, then you can refer to it. So for example, when I was in the bibliography view a second ago, I'm going to show you again. The first one in the at the top was an article by Victoria Stodden. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cite it by citing Stodden in my down here. Let's go up here, for example. I'm just going to edit this paragraph. I'm going to cite Stodden at the very end. And if I save and close, maybe refresh. Oh, yeah, it's already up there. So Victoria is cited up here, and if you go to the bottom of the article, a reference is added for Victoria's article. And you can also cite, this is very important for astronomers. Astronomers, as I said before, use the ADS, which is the Astrophysics Data System, to actually find and work with their literature. So for astronomers, we're allowing them to cite articles by URL. So if you want to cite this article, for example, right here, all you do is you take the URL, and then again you cite, and you input the URL, and save and close, and I hope that that works somehow. Just a second. So, yeah. So Mitchell, this was a paper by Mitchell right there, and if you go to the paper, it's got a cite by Mitchell, and a reference here at the bottom, right there, with a link to the actual article. So now, one last thing. For images, what we're doing right now is that you can cite an image just by dragging and dropping that image into the thing. So I have a figure one in here. If I want to add a new figure, figure two, then what I do is I just put it here, for example, and in a second it should update, and this is figure two within the document. And if I want to move that figure somewhere at the bottom, let's just move it here, for example, then, yeah, it will be here at the bottom. You can use the article index to just do to change the order of things. So if we want to move methods before the abstract, all we do is just move it up there, and that's we reshuffle the way the article looks. But what I wanted to mention here is that what we're doing now for images looks very much like existing tools, what they do with images. So we're still treating images like static, dead objects. The next step and what we're working on right now, and you have, if you know developers or scientists that want to work with us on this, is that we're moving towards a much more dynamic environment. We do know that a lot of scientists use Python or R, Mathematica, and MATLAB, IDL in astronomy. These are the tools that they use to produce an image. We're creating a wrapper for images so that when you include an image from within your MATLAB or Mathematica environment, you're not just including the image, but by double-clicking the image, you can actually access all the data and the processes that were used to produce that image. So step one, which will be ready in just a few days, and I'm too bad that I couldn't show it today, is we're doing that for D3.js, which is a JavaScript-based solution, so that when you produce an interactive plot with the D3.js, you can double-click on an image and access and edit the source code that produced that image. But in the next month, we're moving to Python and R and other tools like that. Now, if I just have 2 more minutes, I'm going to go back to my presentation for a second. I'm sorry, I'm like running. And I'm just going to, so that's the executable part. So I just want to mention 2 things. The first thing is that I'm sort of anticipating some of the questions that I will get. A lot of people ask me, why are you so worried and why are you working with articles? They tell me, like, you're trying to move science beyond articles, but at the same time, you're working with articles still, and you're building a system that essentially is for writing, authoring articles. So my point is this, is that we still, as scientists and scholars, it's articles that we're producing, and that's the one thing that gives us credit and recognition. So we have to start from articles. There's also one other thing. I worked with data libraries and scientific data repositories for a long time, and what I found was very little adoption by scientists and scholars. This is because what I talked about, there's a disconnect between how we write a paper, and which is what we really want as scientists, and how we then deposit sometimes the data, the images, the source code for the paper into a repository, which is what librarians want. I only see this working if we combine these 2 actions. So if writing a paper also means self-depositing all your work, your code, your data in images, then that's the only way to actually advance science and make it more open. And then the second question I get all the time, this is the crucial one, is why open science, right? When I talk to friends about this, friends that are doing research, they go like, ha, you don't know, my supervisor is never going to let me write a paper in the open. What do you think? Like, you know, we have data we spend years collecting, and like, this is never going to happen. So my answer is, well, there's 2 parts. First of all, on the system, we're allowing users to create private accounts, and you can then create an article and just share it with, you know, your group of people and write it in the private, and then whenever you're ready, you can post it in the open. Maybe after you submit to a journal and you export it to a LaTeX or whatever and you submit it to the journal. But there's also something else. I think that we're necessarily moving towards a much more open environment. Whether we want it or not, that's the way that is going to work for us. The reason I say that is because I find myself moving to a much more open environment, which is a little less possessive, and this idea of like possessing the data and you know, just being so attached to data and papers and ideas, we have to move away from that, because I do think that at the end of the day, we're doing science, we're doing scholarship for, you know, the benefit of everyone, of humanity, not just to advance our own careers. And there's also something very personal I'd like to mention here to close, and I know I'm running late, but I'm done. Which is, when I was at UCLA a few years ago doing my PhD, I managed to write a lot of papers. I was collaborating with a lot of people, a lot of scholars outside of my discipline, outside of my field. I just found UCLA to be a very nurturing environment, very collaborative. Coming to Harvard, and I don't want to offend anyone here, but coming to Harvard, I noticed a very competitive environment instead. It's a lot more competitive, and this attachment to ideas and writing papers and putting your name out there is a little more, I see it everywhere. And that's probably how it works, how science works in a much more competitive and in a high-end environment. But I think now, I don't want to sound like Bill Clinton, you know, saying collaboration before a competition, but yes, I think that eventually, if there are two people that are working on a similar idea, and they're doing science, and the moment they start working on a similar topic, instead of, with a system like Authoria, we can actually have them collaborate with one another. We can put them in touch rather than encourage them to work separately and compete with one another. So that's the whole point of why I'm going towards an open science model, and I'm going to stop there. Thank you. That's it.
A couple minutes for questions.
So I, first, by way of context, I mostly write mathematical papers, and so that's the perspective I'm coming from. I agree with everything you say about the problems with the way we write papers today, and Authoria looks wonderful. I want to start using it if it's ready for people to start using to write collaborative papers. But I want to ask some questions about the bigger vision of open science and the whole process being out in the open. I agree with also the message of collaboration over competition. But another reason for the research process sometimes to not be in the open is so that people don't have their inhibitions about, in terms of creativity and mm-hmm. when starting out, about every wart of the scientific process and every bad idea that someone has in uh-huh. a research project being put out there to be criticized later on, that you know that if the research is unsuccessful, it'll just go away quietly. And if it is successful, just the end product is what people will see, and not, think of a student starting out, but even later on. And also I wonder about if we move to a world where the expectation is that the whole process is out there in the open, that's the norm, and people are evaluating individual contributors' contributions by tracing back, this person had this idea. What impact does that have on collaboration, physical collaboration, outside?
Yeah.
Will people feel the need that, well, now we can't meet and brainstorm in a cafe or at a whiteboard. Everything has to be out there on the system so that people will know how to assign me credit at the end of the mm-hmm. process. So these are just questions about this future vision. If you thought about it,
you're absolutely right. The idea of the embargo, sort of allowing scientists, scholars, to give them like little time to just figure out what they're actually doing and getting the paper to a stage that at least looks like a draft. That's totally reasonable. And the second thing you mentioned, yes, that's a problem for GitHub and open source communities as well. There's a lot that goes into a project that simply doesn't end up in a written format or in an online format. Advising, brainstorming, coming up with the ideas. Yes, I agree with you, yeah. And if I can just mention also the fact that we're launching internally in a week. So if you're interested, if you're a scholar and you write papers and you're interested in taking part, we're going to have about 100 users. So if you want to be part of this very first sort of group of early users and send us feedback, then shoot me an email. And we're launching for real in January. So, and if there's another question, time for one or, yeah.
Just a quick one. Maybe papers are side effects of real research, right? We do the research and then we write papers, at least in engineering and physics and, you know, more hard sciences. It's exactly like that. So you start with an engine, which is a sort of version control system for projects, and you use it to control the writing of the results of the projects. Why not to go back all the way around and write a system to sustain the life cycle of doing the research and ending with writing papers.
Do you want to help us? That sounds wonderful. Well, it's just a little more complicated. We're trying to do something similar, at least for the images, so that when you're writing, you're creating your image in MATLAB or Python, then we can capture at least those comments that you use to produce the image and the data for underlying that image. We're trying to capture at least that part of the workflow. It would be wonderful to capture everything and to start off to create a system, an online system for data analysis. It's a little beyond us right now. But yeah, it would be wonderful. As a first step, I think we're going to solve the paper problem. We're going to try.
Hey, so my first question was actually on exactly that, but I was going to ask about a scientific workflow engine integration, uh-huh. Right? And, you know, I'm very excited about the coupling of code, image, data, but I was wondering if, you know, maybe you could push that a little further and integrate with things like fMRI processing pipelines. You know, many specific mm-hmm. fields have their own tools that do their own forms of provenance tracking, and I'd really like to be able to attach that data to whatever result I'm producing. So that's one thing I wanted to ask about. But the other is citation, because if these are live documents, then, you know, you mentioned earlier administrators could delete them, for example, and that's a little disconcerting if it's a public document. You know, I understand there'll still be publications, but assuming these are useful, people are going to want to cite them, and I'm not sure how stable citation works in a living document system.
So for the first question, I'm not going to answer it because I already sort of mentioned it. And it would be wonderful to have such a, you know, workflow system. And there are a lot of workflow systems out there, but creating a generic one is very hard, I think. We're going in that direction if we get to that point. But for the second point, yes. So our plan is to work with libraries, and Harvard Library is the first library that we're collaborating with, to make sure that the system, if we have a deal with Harvard, will sit on a Harvard server, so that everything is, you know, the whole preservation and curation is handled by librarians at the different institutions that we work with. As for the citation, our hope is that when a paper like the one that I had up gets published, so they compose the paper, they're ready to export it to a format and send it to the publisher, when they actually publish the paper, they include the link to their dynamic online version as well. And if the system is sitting on Harvard servers, our hope is that the same way that they do preservation of online objects and documents, the same treatment will be used for Authoria documents. That's my hope. So, yes, I do understand that things might change if a person will leave a document open for more editing. You will be able to refer a version, an exact version of that paper, and you can see, you know, what's changed over time on that version. So that's our plan for now, mostly working with libraries to make sure that they take care of the preservation and curation.
So I think we've got to wrap up, but hopefully Alberto will stick around afterwards to answer some questions, and we just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you.